right, welcome back. This is Congress Two Beers In. I'm here with my, I'm Josh Huter, a senior fellow at GAI at Georgetown University. I'm here with my colleagues, Matt Glassman.
I'm two protein shakes
two
in.
Congress Two Protein Shakes In. And Laura Blessing.
I'm not in anywhere near enough coffee in.
I know. Is it? We've been doing these in the morning, and I'll be honest with you. This is not the right vibe.
It's a real mistake.
It's not the vibe that we're going for on this show. We're going to have to adjust this at some point.
You know, we're in a new office, and we're all redecorating things, and I've got, you know, I'm starting to think about antique bar carts for my place.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
I think it would be a good vibe.
I know.
You know, get like a mace like they have in the house, but like when it's on the pedestal, it's my office. When it's off it, it's a speakeasy.
I like it. I like it. We got to do something, but we definitely need to do something about the vibe here. But we are coming back to a Congress after recess with a lot on its plate, from appropriations to the National Defense Authorization Act to potential crime money to Medicaid subsidies to Russia sanctions. There's just too much to talk about, so we were trying to narrow it down, and we figured we'll wing it. But yeah. the thing that's on everybody's mind.
Why don't you just tell us what you want to talk about, Josh?
The thing that's on everybody's mind right now, a couple things are really hitting the headlines because they've been coming to a boil for quite some time. That's the appropriations picture. Like, how is the government going to stay funded at the end of the month? And then what the administration's trying to do, right?
Yeah.
And on the appropriations side, you've got two parties that are in a bind, right? You've got Republicans who lack the votes in the Senate to fund the government because there's a filibuster. And on the Democratic side, you've got a bunch of people who are furious, who want Chuck Schumer to basically shut down the government for a while.
Right.
And that is just a recipe for not funding the government. And so I'm wondering, like, how you see this sort of like Sisyphean fight that's about to happen as he goes up and tries or attempts to appease a base that's kind of like rabid at the moment.
Well, whoever said that we must imagine Sisyphus smiling was certainly not thinking about Congress.
Yeah.
This is after an incredible calendar year where it's incredible that they passed, you know, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which now may get renamed to something else. I don't know. I'm going to put Oops, I Did It Again out there as a potential title. And so the fact that they did this at all is remarkable, but it also has pushed back appropriations right into the setting that you've just so ably described.
Right, the House has passed two bills, the Senate's passed three bills, that's it,
yeah.
Right? And now we need to negotiate. There's no question, I mean, like, I think half of this is silly, right? It's like, oh, well, is there going to be a deal? No, and there hasn't been a deal in September for a full year appropriation in, I don't know, years, right?
Yeah.
It's been a long, long time. But the question is, like, how do you get the CR across the line?
Yeah, I think the rub this year, which, and again, we say, like, sometimes we say this isn't normal, but at this point, this is normal. Right, we're running up on 15 years here where the appropriations process really is not in a September mood. They've long since given up even pretending that you're going to get something in September. And you see these September CRs well before sort of midnight on the 30th, which used to be when the September CR came, when they really tried to grind it out. And the difference this year is the administration's behavior with regard to executing previous appropriations. And so these fights have taken place, as most people listening to this would know, across all sorts of fronts. Canceling contracts for foreign aid, which is in the realm of quite legal, all the way over to things that have been deemed illegal, like holding up grant money for universities over First Amendment violations and everything in between. But it's pretty clear the Trump administration and OMB Director Vogt see sort of the nature of appropriations as something more like what the English monarch might have seen in the 16th century, where some level of executive branch control over whether money that has been legally appropriated can be spent, their answer is we don't always have to spend it at some level. No one can agree what that number is, you know, where that is. And that's sort of a complete wrench in the process. Because the old bargain, as hard as it was to come up with, was that once we get the bargain, the money gets spent. But now if you try to bargain and the result is the administration might not spend the money on your half of the bargain, what do you do? And this is the jam Schumer's in.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think Matt, you point out the fact that this is like a normal thing, and that's totally true. I mean, like, because, you know, the parties have not been able to pass a budget. They have not been doing kind of responsible budgeting and responsible appropriations in quite some time. So, like, the kind of dance that happens is like, oh, shucks, we weren't able to do it. Oh, no, we're at the deadline. Oh, now we have to strike a bipartisan deal. And at the last second, the leaders get together from, you know, bicameral leadership, bipartisan leadership. They get together, they come up with a deal, and everything goes well. But the administration, like you said, is thrown. I mean, they've essentially reintroduced a line item veto. Like, here's stuff that we don't like, and we just won't spend money for it. And that's like infuriated people because they're. You know, what's the point in making a deal?
They've never sent over the final budget to the Hill. Correct.
Yeah.
This process is so off the rails on the administration side that it's hard to even understand what to make of it, because they do have this idea of, as Trump has in the past, sort of putting in draconian cuts in their budget. You can see this in some of the original House bills, cutting, you know, GAO by like 50% or whatever. And like, none of that is going to end up in the final deal. Like, the players in the Senate are interested in a real deal at some point. But then you have to ask yourself, is it just going to come back and we're going to be fighting in the courts when the president tries not to spend the money in the deal?
Well, and I do think it's appropriate to think about this in terms of levels of dysfunction, because as you said, the past 15 years has not been a very functional process at all. And as Josh has said, we typically are not even passing budget resolutions. But kind of from day one on this, we've seen these guys look at the chinks in the armor that they can possibly exploit. And that's absolutely true on a variety of different levels, whether it's, you know, withholding funds, fighting this out in the courts, but even just on the administrative level, you have Russ Vought at OMB has taken the apportionment process again out of the hands of career civil servants and put them into political officials, which they did the first time around with Trump, but which is highly unusual. And so, not to bore people to tears, but the apportionment process typically goes on a quarterly basis. But not only have they put it in the hands of these political folks, they took down the website announcing these changes in March. A federal judge, after a failed appeal, forced them to put it back up more recently. But these guys are putting little instructions into like all of these different agencies of like, don't do this, don't do that, but it's all legally binding. And so it's not just like the big things that get headlines like, okay, USAID, adios. It's also like a million little trickle attempts from OMB to gut different folks that is really different in 2025 than even the previous 15 years of dysfunction.
All that said, none of it actually matters, because we have the exact same problem within the process Congress set up. The administration now has, for the second time, once in the first Trump administration, and now successfully in the second Trump administration, used the Impoundment Control Act to cut money, which is exactly what Congress wants, right? Congress set the Impoundment Control Act to tell the president, if you don't want to spend money, you should propose rescissions. That is exactly how Congress set this up. It's exactly how it should work. The problem is the Impoundment Control Act lets you rescind money by majority vote on expedited procedures. And so even when you now follow the process everyone who believes in legislative governance, like me, wants them to follow, you end up in the same difficulty of bargaining, because now things that have to overcome a filibuster and get bipartisan support to become an appropriation can, by the very process Congress wants it to happen, be rescinded by majority vote. And we saw this happen with the foreign aid money, $9 billion in foreign aid and money for public broadcasting. And yet, again, have to ask yourself, even if the administration wasn't getting involved in empowerment and doing this all good faith efforts to rescind stuff they didn't like, now those rescissions can be done on a unilateral basis if the Republicans can find the vote for them. It's not easy to find the votes for those sort of rescissions. Right. Spending's popular, but it blows the same hole in the bargaining process over the annual appropriations bills.
Yeah, and it also blows up all the relationships that you're doing. Yeah. You know, and I think it's meaningful that the rescission for foreign aid and public media that you just referenced was H.R. 4 in the House. So by definition, one of the majority party's priority items, right? They get H.R.s 1 through 10 to be like, this is a priority of us. It's a priority of us to not do all the things that we just said that we wanted to do.
Well, I mean, and this goes on top of the fact that they're doing something really unprecedented, which is pocket rescissions.
Yes.
And pocket rescissions are not a thing. Let's make that really clear. This is just an impoundment. And I think they call them pocket rescissions because it sounds like pocket veto, which kind of gives it maybe a more constitutional soundingness to the PR.
These things are garbage.
It's just absolute impoundment. It's just impoundment.
And a pocket rescission, sartorially cute, but not.
Yes. It's essentially like, there's a 45-day window when you trigger a rescission request that you send to the Hill. The Hill has 45 days to act on that request, or the spending must go out. What they've done now is sent a rescission request to the Hill within the 45-day window, and is basically
saying when the money expires.
When the money expires, and which means like if the money expires after 40 days, then there's no chance for Congress to approve or not approve. There's just no decision being made. And so this is sort of a loophole in the bill. This is one that GAO said that should be addressed. Of course, Congress did not address it because they didn't expect this to happen. There are a lot of things Congress did not expect to happen, therefore, and like it put us in this kind of spot.
I mean, GAO says no go on pocket rescissions.
Correct, right. But it's one of those things where there's an expectation of congressional or presidential behavior that they wouldn't do this sort of thing. And this is true of a lot of different powers that the president's been given. But it's put Congress in a really difficult spot. They can't control this. And it's going to happen. Like, the money will be rescinded. It's not going to be rescinded. It'll be impounded. So the money will not be spent, simply because Congress doesn't have the time to act on it. And also the fact that this will have to be adjudicated in the courts later on, right? Yeah. Because the only kind of like mechanism to solve this legally is GAO has to sue the administration.
And meanwhile, you know, the Republicans, you know, are cross-pressured on this because a lot of them substantively agree with these rescissions and what the president's doing. And they're sort of, this is not unusual for members of Congress, prioritizing that over sort of institutional power. And you can see them even proactively like working to make that happen, right? The House has passed a lot of appropriations trying to cut off GAO's ability to take these lawsuits up.
Right.
And so this is, in my view, sort of seriously detrimental for the Hill. I think it's utterly ridiculous. There's no way you can read a statute that was designed to stop impoundments from authorizing unilateral impoundments for 1 month of the year, every year. It's just crazy. And so this is a big fight. The other thing that vote did, or I presume vote did it, is Circular A11 from OMB now took out all the language about impoundments. And so, they aren't itching for that frontal fight because, in my view, that's the fight Congress can win. If we had a square-on case at the Supreme Court, or even in public opinion, that said, can the president not spend money that Congress approved by law, I think Congress wins in public opinion and in the courts. But all these little cuts of these sort of very legalistic details of law, it's much easier for the administration to sort of tangle this up and delay it and win on sort of these crazy readings of particular sentences and bills.
Yeah.
Well, Congress just hasn't been willing to do this, and we've seen this coming ever since, you know, Vought was up for, you know, his nomination is to, you know, to head OMB. I mean, everybody knows that this guy ahead of time thought that the Impoundment Control Act was unconstitutional. So this has been, you know, this has been coming. Like, you could have, you know, I realize you couldn't have predicted all of 2025. There's a whole bunch of things on my I wouldn't have put on my bingo card. But, you know, this is absolutely one of them. And, you know, Congress, we've got the Achilles heel of the Federalist Papers insofar as, you know, the founders don't anticipate parties. And, you know, if Congress cannot act cohesively, they cannot push back. You know, the most that we're seeing with this kind of stuff is people, you know, senators in the press saying, like, gosh, this is the wrong tool to do this, even though I like some of the cuts, as you just said. We saw, like, Susan Collins a couple of weeks ago, I think, started suggesting that she'd put some of the report language into the actual bill itself. Like, that's not a strong pushback.
The pocket rescissions are extremely nasty because, unlike sort of the regular rescissions that at least need to get a majority vote, and then you have at least three senators and the Republican side on record saying this is garbage. The chair of the Appropriations Committee thinks they're unconstitutional. There's House Appropriations Guard. There's no vote taken on a pocket rescission.
Right.
You've got to take some other type of action.
Right. Yeah.
And I think the problem here is that the typical people who scream at this the most in any situation will be sort of the minority party, but they don't have any recourse in the Congress. And so they have to run off to the courts, which is just a dead end on this stuff.
Yeah, the only way to do this is you would need positive action inside Congress.
Yes.
And you could approve the pocket rescission, except reduce the amount that's being rescinded to like $1, right?
But that's
that how we do it. But like, that takes all sorts of creativity. And
also,
it also requires like leaders to be on board with
this.
And like, they have too much pressure from the administration and most of their party to just sit there on their hands, right?
Yeah,
I mean, they prefer the legislature to just not be involved in this.
I mean, this is not a hard solution for Congress. They have also, I wrote about this on Tuesday, so I'm well versed in these solutions. But
wrote a great piece. People should go read it.
Yeah, go read my piece on pocket rescissions. But Congress can easily fix any of this, right? They could rewrite an appropriations bill saying this money is back live and you need to spend every penny of it, right? They could demand the money be spent in the future, right? They could actually start doing the obvious thing to do, which is go tit for tat, which is if you are not going to hold up your end of good faith in the executive branch, then you're going to start losing your money. Right? And you don't get everything at that mansion. You don't get all this money for OMB until we understand, or until you understand, that those perks of the job of the presidency are contingent on you operating in the appropriations and spending world in good faith. Because this is just bad faith action on the part of the executive here. And there's not a whole lot you can do on this stuff if you're going to have fundamental bad faith action on the part of the executive, and the courts aren't coming to save you from bad faith action on the part of the president.
No, well, I mean, he's had one pocket position. I mean, what's to prevent him from doing more of them?
And it's not just him. Right. Like, it's amazing to me that the short-term time horizon of members allows this to go forward, because soon enough, Obama will be back in office, some new Obama, some new Biden, and the Republicans will be screaming about the exact same thing in a different context. We've gone back and forth on this now in four administrations. It keeps escalating, and Trump has taken it to 11 in ways that are beyond what they did. But this is, how different is this than student loans? How different is this than Obama Medicaid expansion? It's not, right? It's the same thing. And members just are cross-pressured too much over the short term for substantive policy goals and partisan sort of coherence.
Yeah,
I think it's, I'm not saying that you don't have presidents kind of pushing the envelope, and like the student loans thing with, Biden was pretty unusual, but I think Trump is above and beyond qualitatively different.
Yeah,
and
Trump
legally
definitely,
different
Trump
and
definitely is on
different.
This, but the thing about the Trump stuff right now is this really is the principled level stuff. It's $9 billion. It's $5 billion. Like, this isn't a lot of money right now.
Yeah.
But once this becomes embedded as a precedent, you better believe that the flunkies over at OLC at DOJ are going to be writing about this and say, well, he did it, right? And that is not going to be something that Democratic presidents are going to ignore. They're just not going to.
The big problem here is, everybody wants Congress to sort of jealously guard its prerogatives and
yes.
its power. And that's like the idea behind the framing and all this stuff. Like, there are a couple problems with this, and we've spoken about this before. Like, one is, this stuff takes place over time, right? And, people just we have the student loan thing, and we have all these other precedents that go on there. Nothing has been this much of an affront to the congressional spending power since Nixon, right? So it's been a long, long time. Nobody's been around, since we've had that. So there's been no experience, right?
Honestly.
There's been no experience with this.
Yeah, this is very different.
And during that period of time, it took 3 years for Congress to sort of get its act together,
yeah.
right? And the House Appropriations Chair was on board with Nixon impounding funds in 1971, but in 1974, he's authoring the resolutions to undo Nixon's power, right? I mean, this is the same person. It took 3 years to get there, right, for that third action to happen. So it takes, one, it takes time. And two, what's fundamentally different now about than the 1970s, though, and this puts a huge caveat on that little story about political time and how it matters, is that the constituencies of members of Congress are so much more interwoven with the constituency of the presidency.
Yes.
And that is an enormous problem from a separation of powers perspective, because you cannot have an independent legislature if the constituents that elect legislators are not independent of the president's constituents
yeah.
to some degree, or at least enough for it to be politically valuable to create independence. And this goes back to, incumbent advantage and all those other things. Like, incumbent advantage used to be 18%, right? On average. So, on average, the average incumbent in Congress ran 18% better than the president
yes.
in their district,
yeah.
right? That creates an enormous buffer for you. The president could, be completely underwater, and you're doing just fine on re-election. That incumbent advantage, the same one, is below 2% now. So members of Congress see the president's approval and they're like, oh man, I guess I'm in trouble. But there's very little incentive to actually buck him, because you're the same voters, right?
We also just have different, partisanship is different, media systems are different. I see a lot of the pushback against Nixon is a system with guardrails that are pretty substantially eroded by now.
The other place you see this, which I thought was very striking in the last couple of weeks, is on the redistricting stuff.
Yeah.
One thing that sort of always kept redistricting at bay was that a lot of members of Congress like the other kind of redistricting, not the partisan redistricting, but the incumbent protection redistricting.
Right. And those are different.
And
right?
Completely
yeah.
different. And one, you want to minimize the amount your party is winning each seat by so that you can create more of them.
That's what Texas is doing now,
yes.
right? In the mid-cycle.
The other one is that you cut a deal with the other party and you make all the seats safe for everybody.
And this is what Texas did after 2020.
Yes.
It made all the seats. They didn't get that many seats, but they did buffer all the incumbents.
And
so it made it harder for them to be unseated.
In the age when parties weren't nationalized and when the presidency's constituency didn't overlap with the members' constituency so much, it's the members who were winning with 62% of the vote who would be going down to like 54% of the vote if you did this redistricting to squeeze out more seats, they would have thrown a shitstorm if you tried to do this. They were the ones pushing back against it. They didn't want to turn their seats into sort of like actual, like modestly competitive ones. Now that's over. It just looks like squeeze every drop out of this. It's hard to resist. And I do think someone's going to get burned by this. There's going to be someone who's going to end up in a district that they missed the wins and it got gerrymandered too hard and they end up losing because of it. But that is sort of, I think, very indicative of what you're talking about, Josh, where that the overlap of the congressional party and the presidency is at a level of sort of completeness now that it changes sort of the calculus of members almost completely in regard to these separation of powers issues.
Well, they're also willing to support unpopular things. You know, we've seen more support for the reconciliation bill than should have been predicted, given how popular or rather unpopular this thing is. We also should have seen some level of district variation. So people like Valadao, who 2/3 of the guy's constituencies on Medicaid, I've heard from humans I know that, he stood up in closed rooms and said things about it. That did not translate to any votes. You know, we saw Tillis on the Senate floor voting against it because he had already decided not to run for re-election. That is an unusual pattern and a pretty big break. From previous politics, I don't think we should underscore how big of a power grab this is by Trump.
A generation ago, this is what political scientists yearned for, right? Like disciplined European style parties, and like it is weird to see it happen and be like, wait a second, we have a presidency in our system. Maybe you don't want disciplined parties in a presidential system.
It's exactly right. I mean, you read I do a bunch of research actually right now about the 1950s, and you just read the stuff like, we need responsible parties, and like, you idiots. You have no idea. Yeah, a bunch of morons.
Yeah,
and they're like smart, but like that's what they're pining for back then. Yeah. And they honestly did need more responsible parties than what they had. They needed more parties that made more sense, that were more coherent, that had like platforms that people could judge on. But we've gone to the other extreme.
Making this point to a bunch of people recently is that there's this sort of mythic view of a lot of Americans that we threw a tyrannical king overboard and built sort of a very anti-monarchy republic. But that's not really true, right? We have the republic with the most king-like figure of sort of our peer countries. The parliamentary systems are the ones that finally sort of abolish the monarchy as a persistent force. And so I think, we do have a separation of power system.
It's like that great Gordon Wood quote. We revolted against the British, but on behalf of their constitution.
Yes. And like, so our system's
conservative
older.
Conservative revolution and, argument.
Yeah, and they couldn't have imagined the parliamentary systems working, right, the modern ones. And so they built something that resembled what they had, which was a king-like figure. And to me, all that means is that you need to be that much more careful about sort of ceding power to the executive figure. And the parliamentary system, there's no sort of independent sort of voter popularity of these prime ministers. The parties easily replace them at times when they don't like them anymore. And you don't get these sorts of personalist cults of power that you can get in the American system. And you don't get this sort of continually entrenching power ratchet up in the executive branch. So it's like right when we can do the least about it is when you need the stuff the most in a system that needs it most.
Right.
And I don't know. Go ahead, Josh.
Well, what's ironic about this is you bring up like the personalist part of power, and that's totally true. Yeah. This is the most personalist politics I've ever seen in American politics, and it's the most personalist that I can remember reading about either. Mm-hmm. Like, it's sort of stunning to watch. And he's ridden this wave of populism into the White House, but now it's sort of like populism is coming back to bite him because there's a lot of populism on Capitol Hill that's sort of like, And in particular, the Epstein files is one of these things, right?
That is the craziest segue.
Oh yeah, but it's like, but
I've
but
seen
you can
a
see
long
this,
time.
Right? We've had multiple sort of bipartisan, like AOC next to Marjorie Taylor Greene, press conferences, whether it's the Epstein files or it's stock bans. There's a lot of discharge activity right now in the House of Representatives. There's a lot of momentum in the Senate, although the Senate's kind of more muted. I think they're less enthusiastic about either one of those things. But it's this populist style of politics where the outsides are sort of ganging up on the middle because they have just different ecosystems, right, that are kind of creating incentives about that. What do you guys think of what's happening on, do either of these things like move forward? Like, what do you make of the style of politics that's sort of kind of eating the House and the Senate at the moment?
Oh gosh, I mean, I do think that they're like interesting asterisks on the side, though. Like, I don't think we're going to see a lot of, like, two ends against the middle, like, potential success stories. You know, I do think that this is quite the aberration, and we should be framing it as such. Yeah, I mean, just for our listeners, discharge petitions have incredibly unlikely rates of success. You basically have to do an end route around the House. Party leadership that, you know, normally rules in a very hierarchical fashion and gets its way and enforces that those desires. So, you know, you need to get 218 votes to move a piece of legislation to the floor. So these almost never pass. You know, historical exceptions are things like campaign finance in the early aughts.
Ex-Im Bank.
Ex-Im Bank as well. Yeah. Yep. But, you know, there's a handful of these in the past two decades, you know, like it's very, very rare. I've been trying to not think too much about the Epstein stuff, so I'll you know, leave my kind of context here. And if Matt wants to take a crack at the level of, I don't know, people using a political football over, to be sure, a lot of criminal activity that someone should do something about. But
So the Epstein stuff I've not talked about much because I don't have a ton to add, except that I find the politics of Epstein to be sort of multi-tiered. You have the people who see Epstein as just horrific, you know, sex crimes of the worst nature, right? And it's just this horrible person. But then you have the second level, which is like, this case is just really weird, right? Like, why is Jeffrey Epstein friends with all these people? Where does money come from? That stuff. And then you have the third tier, which is the true conspiracy theorists who think Jeffrey Epstein was running sort of like a satanic underground cult up at Comet Pizza or whatever. And the interaction,
which does not have a basement.
Right. The interaction of those three tiers into the politics of, like, Yesterday on the Hill is absolutely, like, bananas to me. Because you have the literal victims of this guy. People who are at the bottom level, like, the most hurt by any of this, sort of standing by politicians who are, in my view, quite cynical about this whole thing. First the Republicans for a decade or more, and now the Democrats, right, sort of seeing this as a way to tie up the president. And so, to me, it's a very bizarre spectacle of sort of the saddest, worst things that can happen in sort of in a Republican, in any sense, with sort of, like, absolute sort of, you know, brass tacks power politics.
Right.
And I don't know what's going to happen. You know, it looked for sure going into the break that Massey and his discharge crew were going to get the votes. I'm a little more skeptical now. And this is one thing about discharge petitions that I think really are always important to remember, is that you don't need, you know, 218 votes. You need 218 votes that can't be bought off and can't be cross-pressured out of it. If you have 218 hell-bent people, you can do whatever you want in the House. It's very hard to find hell-bent people in the House of Representatives who don't have sort of competing values, competing things. You already saw some members who were sort of going to be on the discharge petition saying, well, you know, the bill over at House Oversight, the release stuff by the administration looks good, and there's some flaws. And you see people sort of buckling. And so I'm not sure ultimately anything is going to happen there. Now, that said, I'm not clear on the politics of this stuff. This stuff is sort of a nuisance to Trump and persisting there in the background, but sometimes it's just better to get the stuff out there and just exhaust itself. If this stuff lingers over Trump, it may never go away at some low boiling level, which is exactly where you don't want conspiracy theories to live within your own party.
Yeah, and that's the problem. I mean, the discharge petition aside, like, that, it's not going to change the fact that this will be something that is introduced into every congressional debate by Democrats, right? This is like, they see this as point of leverage. It's the first time they've really been able to crack the Republican coalition, like, in this way. Like, I can't, in the last 20 years, right? I mean, it's been an issue that's got unique salience among the Republican base, and Democrats are just grabbing on it. They're going to ride it as long as they can. I mean, like, they might be more satisfied if nothing comes out for a long time, and they can just use this as a cudgel for the rest of the Congress. So it matters, right? It matters in the sense that it will affect Congress's ability to do stuff, particularly in the House. The Senate, you know, the Senate's got its own problems. But the House is going to be a real issue with this kind of bubbling in the background. The Senate's problems, on the other hand, deal with the fact that there's a filibuster still. It's 2025, and there is still a filibuster in the Senate, and that is insane to say. But this filibuster and this kind of right unlimited debate refuses to go away, and so the Senate is kind of grappling with nominations all the time. It's become the world's most opulent HR department, where they just sit there and they process nominations from the Justice Department, from the executive branch, or the
world's most exclusive HR department.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's just sort of insane. But the Senate should not be spending this much time on nominations, right? That's all they're doing right now. They don't really talk about legislation anymore. It's just justices. It's just executive branch officials. And so Republicans are sort of like, well, now what do we do? This is something I thought Democrats might have moved on in the last Congress. They didn't for whatever reason. And so Republicans have now taken it up, and they're trying to figure it out. But the problem is every single vote takes 2 hours of debate, and then you have to set up the next vote. And so you could get about four, maybe five nominations a day processed. And so it's going to take a lot of days in order to process all the nominees that are up for confirmation. And so it doesn't surprise me in this sense here, but it does kind of leave it in a spot where it's like we're going to see more of those minority protections winnowing away because of the abuse of the filibuster.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Josh for that excellent segue. That was very smooth. But yeah, we've seen Thune just kind of like racking and stacking the stuff and spending a lot of time on votes. To be sure, I mean, we're roughly at the point in terms of how many people have actually been nominated and how many people have been confirmed and how many people have been nominated but not confirmed, that we've seen, you know, pretty comparable to where Biden was. You know, that being said, yeah, this is tying up the Senate in a pretty significant way, and they're thinking about moving forwards on it. But, you know, there's all of these different things have been breaking trust down in Congress even more. And Congress is a lot of things, but Congress is also a workforce and a workplace. And, you know, if, you know, you have stuck your thumb in so many people's eyes, especially over all the, you know, highly unusual things in 2025, is going to be harder to move forward. You know, there have been, like, Rubio was the only guy who wasn't filibustered. you know, so as much as like there's some ways of comparing this to under Biden, like this is an unusual level of Democratic pushback. Yeah. I'm not sure how many people who are reading the newspaper and who are critical of Schumer fairly are kind of seeing that, but it absolutely affects congressional workload.
You know, it strikes me that this is sort of like the least the Democrats can do. Right,
right. And they're
like,
doing it.
Yeah, exactly.
Just like it's like Collins being like, I'm going to put in the bill language is the least they can do on appropriations.
Their base is demanding that they take back the spending power and that they undo the actions at USAID, all of which things Democrats cannot do, right? So what can they do? Well, they can make nominations a really slow process.
Yeah.
So they're kind of doing that. But
I would favor, at this point, nominations reform. I think it's relatively nonsensical to get rid of the true filibuster on nominations, but allow it still to be dragged out to a point where people are impeding the process. And some of these reforms don't have to be sort of Senate procedural reforms, right? We could cut down the number of advising consent positions in the executive branch. I don't think...
Well, that would be a good reform.
I mean, right now there's about 1,200, and honestly, like, assistant secretaries at a lot of these places don't need to be sort of confirmed by the Senate. It's just a waste of time. And so that's one avenue. I'm not. I'm also not against, you know, en bloc considerations of nominations. You could even do an en bloc consideration, you know, under certain circumstances, right? Like if they had hearings or something like that. But this is not serving Congress to have this go this way, because it fuels the other problem, which is that you end up with the Vacancy Act and the executive branch is throwing all sorts of flunkies into all sorts of places you never intended. And so I would be in favor of reforming this. I don't think it gets the minority a whole lot, honestly, that would be holding up this process.
Right. And you know, I completely back the whole en bloc nomination thing. Let's just do this all in one chunk. I mean, it's how they did it before through unanimous consent, right? We're just going to do a bunch of nominees through UC.
There should be some level of limitations on it. I mean, Klobuchar suggested 10. right? And so they're currently talking in like unlimited terms about en bloc stuff.
Yeah, and I think that makes a lot of sense. I still like Congress having the personnel power. So I don't like, you know, we could certainly talk about reducing the number of confirmable nominees, confirmable positions, but like I'm more or less pro that because if they do want to affect the agency, this is like one of their best ways to do it. But I do think like this is just it's gotten to a point where it's absurd, right? It's just taking up way too much time, the Senate, and the Senate's not legislating anymore. It's just not, and yeah. I don't know if that's a function of nominees, but like it's certainly an excuse for them not to turn to legislation and just say like, oh, well, we've got to do all this nominee stuff. So it's a difficult spot for Congress to be in, for the Senate to be in, but the filibuster is still a thing, and that's depressing because the filibuster's lame, right? It no longer serves a real big purpose.
Well, I mean, with this stuff, like, you have kind of this particular manifestation of the age-old question of congressional dysfunction, which is it a procedural problem or is it like people and policy not coming together? You know, like if the nature of some of these nominees or if the nature of some of the stuff that these folks were dealing with was less contentious, less unusual, more likely to have people actually like come together, we might have less of a problem. You know, like not all of this is like a procedural change potential fix here, you know. And I do think you know, Josh, that a limited number of en bloc nominations would be fine. I do think, Matt, that like, you know, there's been some kind of generic bipartisan groups talking about like, wow, they were just asking for way too many nominations for the federal, for the executive branch at this point, and like it's too hard for everybody, regardless of
I think you're
party.
Being too nice to the Senate, man. We're running the clock out here, and nominees that get 88 votes in the end. Like, yeah. What the hell are we doing?
Yeah, and that's the thing that kills me. Is like this is the problem with the filibuster as well, right? We're filibustering bills that have 90 votes in support. Right?
Oh, sure.
We should not take 2 weeks to process that bill, right? If there are 90 votes in support, it just should not take that much time to do it. But the reality is 10 senators can force that.
Right. I mean, one thing we could do in the Senate that would be a halfway measure is we could revive suspension of the rules as a practice, right? Because two-thirds of the senators can cut out a lot of the funny business if we revive that. Right now, it's cumbersome and they use it occasionally, right? It's not super effective. But if you think that, like, a supermajority should be able to get its will worked quickly, right? You could adopt sort of suspension procedures that mimic the House more than sort of traditional Senate practice and let them go at it.
You know, I think a lot of senators kind of like shy away from that practice because there are no amendments on suspension of the rules procedures. Yeah. And that's traditionally been something that senators love to do.
Yeah.
But we're also in a Senate right now where there are no amendments on anything anyway. Right? So it's like, what's the point? Like, I've got this thing. It's like, you never use it. So just let's pretend, let's just like admit the reality and you don't get any nominations or any amendments anymore.
Yeah. I'm just saying that like, the nature of some of these individual people who are being nominated, and I don't have, I'm just judging on past nominations, are legitimately concerning, slash unusual. But we also have like unusual firings that we're seeing, you know, like I look at a lot of fiscal and monetary policy and just like, you know, last month firing the BLS commissioner after a jobs report he didn't like, and firing Lisa Cook at the Fed is just extremely
trying to fire Lisa Cook at the Fed.
Sure, she's pushing back. She's pushing back. That's going to be a legal issue. That's going to be fought out. It's just highly unusual. Really concerning stuff. And of course, you know, the person who wants a BLS is, you know, a heritage economist who's been pretty universally panned by experts across the political spectrum. The Fed, of course, is using data from the BLS to come up with a variety of different analyses and decisions. you know, so these are not kind of neutral appointments or executive personnel changes that he's attempting here.
All right. Well, we've been speaking for about 38, 39 minutes, and everybody knows nobody listens to a podcast longer than 40 minutes. So
we're done.
Do we have any final points before we kick off?
What would you rename the Big Beautiful Bill Act, everybody?
Yeah. That's a great question. a lot of stuff for a lot of people. I don't have a good thing. But in any event, all right, that does it for us. We will be back in a week or two with more content and more stuff, I'm sure, happening in Congress, because it's going to be a hell of a month.
Doesn't stop.
All right. See you then.
Can't stop, won't stop.
Bye.